Hi, everyone. This is Dean Hagler from the offices of Rational Exuberance here in the heart of the historic core of downtown Los Angeles in the middle of the Art Deco wonder known as the Eastern Columbia. You are listening to your Chilpec Hollywood Hour, and I'm here with my co-host who's already frantically tweeting that we've started the show. Mr. Phil Lernest, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Dean Haglund.
Where were you tweeting that from?
I wasn't... Actually, you can follow me at Twitter at twitter.com/dhaglund.
That's me.
Oh, well, you can follow me at twitter.com/phillernest.
That's right.
But what I was actually doing was turning off my phone because we've had some trouble when the phones aren't off.
Oh, that's right. Luckily, mine is up at the gym. Oh, no, mine's right over there.
Yeah, maybe you ought to check to make sure that that's...
turned off as well.
Turned off.
Because that makes that noise.
And, it was kind of interesting, and it was not an intentional reference in any way. But I got into this last week tweeting and posting on our Facebook accounts about my favorite reasons why I love public transportation. Because, as you know, I've had to do some driving lately, and I just hate it. And I hate everything about it.
It's, yeah.
And so I found myself tweeting about reason number 86 why I love public transportation. And someone, of course, wrote, please list the previous Ocho Cinco reasons why you enjoy public transportation. Because I am the podcast artist formerly known as Ocho Cinco.
Luckily. And I'm certainly much better than when you were Noofity Noof. I gotta tell ya. So, yes, 86 reasons to love public transit. One of them, napping.
That was number 86. That was because I took a lovely 1 hour nap.
That's excellent. And that you can tweet while get all your tweets in, particularly if you have a, BlackBerry or iPhone.
I'm going to list some of these other sites where people can reach us because it might become critically important that people be able to reach us and that we be able to reach our listeners because we referenced before in the past that big changes might be coming, big changes that might unfortunately lead to an interruption, especially in iTunes subscriptions.
That's right.
And also an interruption in being able to get some of our back catalog of shows.
True enough.
At least for a little while. So you can, of course, be a friend of the show on MySpace, myspace.com/ChilpacHollywood.
We're still there.
We check in there once a week, whether we need to or not. We bundle up against the cold draft that's blowing through that place.
Way to go, Rupert Murdoch.
You can be a liker of the show on Facebook at facebook.com/ChilpacHollywood. And
we, of course,
read everybody's posts and messages to us there. And, of course, you can write us each and every week, or whenever you want to. You can be writing us right now. Chilpack Hollywood, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K Hollywood, at yahoo.com.
That easy.
And no matter how you listen to this show, whether you listen to this show via download on our official website, chilpackhollywood.com,
or streams the show.
Or if you stream the show and listen to it on Jackalope Radio. Or at the Talk Superstation, talksuperstation.com, on
our
the cockroach.
Newest. Yes.
Yeah. However you listen to this show, or via subscription on iTunes, we would love it, if you've never done so before, if you dropped us a line at chilpackhollywood@yahoo.com. Maybe let us know how you find the show, how you listen to the show, but also so that we have an email address for you so that in case... there is an interruption, we can contact you and let you know where to tune in your area for news and information.
How to find us.
Soup kitchens will be set up.
Exactly.
Shelters. Rations will be set aside.
Large signage with our pictures pointing you to the direction to hear our show. It'll be that easy. We're going to set that up city to city.
Yeah. So should we talk about what the change is and why it might be happening, or should we just save that for
Let's save that just one more week.
Yeah, let's wait to burn our bridge.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's burn that bridge when
we actually are burning it.
Cross over
when we're on it. Yeah. Let's burn the bridge when we're on it.
Burn that bridge when we come to it.
Because then that's a fire that you love to be.
Speaking of big changes, however.
Go for it.
Last week, and for really 191 weeks prior to that,
yes,
going on 4 years prior to that, I co-hosted a weekly podcast show that, dare I say, has been changing the way people listen to the internet since May of 2007.
Yep.
With a Canadian.
Yeah.
By the name of Dean Haglund.
Yes.
And though you may still be Canadian by birth, you are now if not by temperament, then certainly by legalization.
Shut your hole! Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that repressed Canadian rage now has to be on the surface.
Absolutely, because I'm now an American.
Right.
That was, yeah.
You were sworn in.
I was sworn in with, I think it was, they said it had to be limited to 3,500 people, but it looked more like 4,000 to 6,000 people there. It was huge, a massive amount of us from 106 different countries came together, all filled out our proper paperwork, all stood up, raised a right hand, and got sworn in, and it was quite the ceremony. They sang the national anthem. Barack Obama videotaped the message. There was that song, Proud to Be an American, like with all the fields
really?
Of wheat. Yeah, they played that. And they announced, hey, we need someone who can translate Russian for one of the guys at the table signing in. So somebody jumped up and helped out there. And then some other poor woman got kicked out because it seemed like she was having a real bad acid trip. So it was quite an adventure.
Did it touch you? Did it move you?
Yeah, it was actually, there's a little tear come in the eye there.
Wow. Bit.
Yeah, it's kind of neat. It's kind of like, hey, you're joining the country. And it's like, ah, oh, that's fun.
Welcome to one of the top 20 nations in the world.
That's right. Get working on that healthcare.
Well, that's very exciting. Welcome. Yeah,
thank you.
You know, as a callback to a rant that you went on.
Uh-oh.
You know, often I'm the one on the soapbox.
Yes.
However, occasionally something will really just stick in your craw and you'll
Mylar balloons at funerals.
How'd you know this was the one? How did you know this was it? Yes.
It just came
so many people contacted me asking me if they could get an address where they could send Mylar balloons. Now, your thing, for those of people who just are joining us, you talked about how, I guess we were talking about how odd and really inappropriate or just lack of connection we have to real grieving in this country whatsoever.
True.
The euphemisms we use for death, passed away as opposed
away.
To die. You know,
gone
we tried to deny death its due.
Right.
And one of the things that bothered you about that was
Mylar balloons. A Mylar balloon in the shape of a teddy that says "Miss you," stuck at the either at the funeral itself or where the car crashed. That right. kills me. Like on the side of the road.
Yeah.
What? How?
Flowers, candles, teddy bears, and Mylar balloons on a sidewalk.
Yeah.
Surrounding Michael Jackson's star.
Yeah.
When he dies. Or, you know, yeah, just in public places, these Mylar balloons.
So horrible.
And there's nothing worse for the environment than a Mylar balloon,
no,
right?
They don't recycle. They last 1,000 years. There's metal in
plastic. They literally do not die, and I think that's the message.
Is that what it is?
However, what I suggested to people, and I don't know if this will happen, but what I suggested to people who wanted to bring forth Mylar balloons, especially because what they were mourning... grieving the death of Dean Haglund, Canadian, is really it, especially the Canadian fans who really feel betrayed by it.
Well,
this.
You see, I get to keep my Canadian passport, though.
Shh.
What?
You're not supposed to.
Yes, you
According
are.
To America, no, you're not supposed
oh,
to.
I can't
yeah,
be dual.
No, you can't be dual. We do not recognize dual citizenship in this country. Yeah. Canada does, and the other countries do, but America does not recognize it. Yeah.
Hey, Canadian?
Yeah. Don't let them know that you're carrying dual passports. And don't walk around with dual passports, because, you know, that looks awfully phony.
That's it.
Anyway, but thank God we're talking about this before we actually start the podcast.
Yeah, oh. I should let you know.
But what I suggested
yes.
That was that they should really
be
capture their feelings about this by in using some really recognizable part of, for example, Vancouver as a backdrop.
Uh-huh.
Set up candles, teddy bears, Mylar balloons with a sign, Dean Haglund, Canadian, and then the year of your birth and the year that you stopped being a Canadian, and use that as a backdrop, and then send us, and we would post those pictures on
Absolutely.
The website.
Absolutely, and I would just rage, don't buy Mylar balloons. Oh my gosh. So you're going to do that. Okay, well, yes, please, everyone, something maybe around the old theater, sports theater. On Granville Island. There's my 8x10 still there.
And when we say, you know, give death its due, you know, I mean, life, the process of life is replete with endings, is it not? And
it
if
is.
You do not honor the endings, you do not truly allow for new beginnings.
It's true.
We had an ending this past week of the completion of post-production sound.
How about that?
On our movie, The Truth Is Out There.
That has been an ordeal, sir.
So there's one more major step left, which is the high definition online and mastering, where we'll do all our color corrections and make our mastering. And that's an important step in the process because, for example, our deals with our investors begin the moment we master the film.
Ah.
7-year contracts begin.
That's where they begin.
Right then.
Click.
So that's an important phase, but it'd just be nice to have it be done. And then, of course, the real work begins, which is the work of bringing it to audiences around the world.
Right.
Which may be starting at the tail end of February.
Right.
With a little sneak preview screening.
It's somewhere for those who are in the Oakland.
San Leandro, San Francisco Bay Area. In San Leandro at the Historic Ball Theater on February 26th, Saturday, February 26th. We're going to do a sneak preview,
a sneak screening preview
of the film.
As part of the
UFO X-Fest Quest for Truth contest.
Quest for Truth contest,
and,
that's right.
People can find out more information at UFOXFest.com.
Yes, for our very first sneak preview. Very exciting.
And, of course, anything that you want to find out about the film, you can find out. You can see the trailer, and very soon, if you make sure that this happens, Dean Haglund, we'll have a contact form on the website, truth-is-out-there.com. Or, of course, you can like the film on Facebook, facebook.com/truthmovie, where on both those places we will always post the latest news. And it's great if you are on Facebook, like the film there, because we will make sure to send you personal messages anytime the film screens in an area conveniently located to where you are.
See that?
We will take that effort to do that.
We will make
and if you contact us, if you're not on Facebook and you contact us through the Truth Is Out There website, or again, really at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com, because we read all of those.
All of it.
We will make sure to make a note and let you know where and when you can see it in your area.
That'd be so cool. And come and check it out.
I feel like I'm just doing pretty much just
commercials.
Yeah, commercials.
We'll talk about what's under my laptop then.
I'll let you start it. What is under both our laptops? You know, I was having a problem. Actually, I should talk about this. I have this fantastic Hewlett-Packard monstrosity.
It's huge.
The DV8. It's a quad system. It's I don't know what it all is, but it's an enormous laptop. It's super powerful. It's great for editing. It's incredible for graphics.
Looks
Blu-ray.
Great.
It both plays and burns Blu-ray.
How rare.
Discs. So it does a lot of things that we need it to do. It also gets so hot, so fast. And you may have seen that I was having this problem where heat starts to create problems in just the operating right now. And one of the things, ways that, that those problems manifest is that the bass and treble control bars pop up on screen and are adjusting themselves as if I was playing something back and trying to adjust the sound, but I'm not. I've got the sound deactivated. Heat causes that.
Wow.
And I said to you right before we came on that I might have to do a restart because I might have to go in and deactivate this whole panel
right
while we're doing it so that I can read my notes for today's show. Instead, put the chill pack underneath it, and seriously, now this problem's not happening at all, is it?
No, I didn't even know that was the problem.
And that's what the Chill Pack does in my experience and why I use it so much and why I have more than one that I swap out. It takes my laptop computer, keeps it running far more efficiently, keeps it running faster, and no doubt is increasing the lifespan of this machine that's very important to me by keeping it cool.
Yeah, that's right, because heat will actually shorten the lifetime of your laptop.
And the Chill Pack is easily affordable. It's quite inexpensive. It's easy to use, and it's environmentally friendly, perhaps most important of all.
Mm-hmm.
And people can find it at chillpack.com, chillpack.com.
So easy. So what a show we got for you today. Oh, wait.
Do we have any time left?
No, that's it. We're no. No, that's not true.
How about I follow up on two things that we left on the table last week?
Yes.
The first requires a clarification. I had a wonderful talk with the producers and executive producers of this short film that I've been offered that involves vampires.
Not zombies.
Not zombies. I get people like offering their services. Hey, if you do end up doing this zombie short film, will you? Maybe you could consider me for the music.
Because that's
and
me.
I just want to scream, it's not a zombie film.
And that's my fault because I was saying
over and over again.
So the zombie
because
film.
I lumped vampires, zombies, and serial killers all together
Yeah. So
the
fact that
I am hypocritical enough to entertain doing one of them.
That makes you only
one-third
a hypocrite. So
no, and you know, again, it was very interesting that we got the question, if I had to do one of these things, how would I do it? And we talked about, you know, you really need to bring the metaphor back to life.
Right.
Breathe life back into it, because, you know, you don't share necessarily my feelings about the zombies or the serial killers, but you yourself have been very upset about how the defanged, denuded archetype of the vampire
absolutely
has become, you know, sort of tarnished currency.
Even if it's
you know, achieving unparalleled economic success.
Yeah, but that's a testament to marketing and knowing exactly what's in the tween's head. You know, this is...
And do we feel that these things that are achieving such success, like the Twilight movies, which appeal to a certain audience right now, do we think that that would be able to find an audience 15 years from now? And I don't think so.
Okay.
Whereas I think, like, the vampire movie that you love so much, and I did as well, Let the Right One In.
Yes.
This is a film that...
It's going to last. Not,
because it achieves a tone that resonates right now, but also a tone that will ambiate forward many years, and will be one of those, I think, that no doubt becomes evergreen as a title. Like Murnau's Nosferatu, for example.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I would think that we're going to see Twilight the way we see, Breakfast Club, but it's something, I'm trying to think, that was a big hit.
But that kind of holds up.
It kind of holds up. What's one that doesn't hold up?
And
Gleaming the Cube.
And the thing is, I don't even think of Breakfast Club as a vampire movie. But I guess that vice principal, played by the late Paul Gleason, he really was kind of an energy vampire sucking all the fun out of being in high school.
That's right. Very good.
So
way to stretch that metaphor.
I do promise to... certainly, all the material is there in this short film script to give me the opportunity to breathe life into this this myth.
You have an idea.
I have many ideas.
Any of them good?
So I might know by this time next week whether or not I am for sure doing it.
Fantastic.
As with all these things, sometimes it comes down to negotiating schedule and money. And, of course, not just, you know, as a director, it's not just about what you yourself need, but about the people around you that you need in order to be able to do this. So we'll see what happens.
Excellent.
The other thing was, we took some real time last week to address our listener Ulrika's question about how we are both children
of our time.
Uh-huh. And as we talked about over the weeks, you know, you can't really separate out time and place entirely. And I had one story that I decided to leave for this week because...
it was long.
Well, it opens up a wide range of discussions. And it was about the fact that, I was thinking about when we grew up in terms of technology.
Yes.
And, you know, we talked about that a little bit, like about how, you know, you couldn't get any music that you wanted. You know, you'd have to travel to a city to find a particular store
album.
To be able, or, you know, or if it was a band that you wanted to learn more about, but it was a band from somewhere else in the world.
Yeah.
You know, I had to go to San Francisco to be able to find in the Haight-Ashbury, you know, a bookstore that would have a magazine article about that from months ago, no doubt, because, you know, it took months to get magazines over on ships. But
it's
anyway,
crazy.
But another way that technology, especially digital technology, has changed things is not just filmmaking. And I was fortunate enough, I really do believe, to grow up at a time when, yes, video was starting to become accessible, so my friends and I could make little video movies, but also when I was in film school, really had to learn on film.
Right, the old school.
And I've talked about that before, but one aspect of technology and being a child of the times that I don't think I've ever discussed is, you know, when you went to the movies, unlike now, when you went to the movies, they always were on film.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to see less and less of that as time goes on. And when I was a child, I was not particularly interested in what was going on screen.
Why?
What fascinated me
was the technology.
Was what was going on in that projection booth.
How did that
The man
work?
Behind the curtain.
Right.
And so as a child of like 3 years old,
I
would be propped up in my chair facing backwards because I liked seeing how an audience was reacting to what was going on screen. I also was fascinated by this flickering machine up in the projection booth.
That you could see through the little window.
And what I became very aware of as a child of three
mm-hmm.
was 2/3 of the time we're in a movie, we're not watching anything.
Because it's black.
Because when you watch the projector, you realize that we project at 24 frames per second. That's exactly 1/3 of what the capacity is, which is 72 frames per second. You could shoot at 72 and project at 72, and you would have so much more information that would be visible on the screen that the human eye could read. 24 frames per second shooting and projecting is the minimum to create the illusion of constant motion. At that point, if you go less, everything starts to blur.
Right.
So that's the illusion of constant motion. And why was it 24? Well, because then you don't have to use as much film.
Right.
You're the reels don't have to be as big.
Right.
So you're saving money that way.
Right. And weight and, you know, logistics.
But so what became apparent to me was this magic, this alchemy that was taking place, which is you really do get to see that these are still images.
Right.
A series that are being projected, but it would be dark image, right?
Right.
2/3 of the time. It's 2/3 of the time the screen is black that you are looking at. So in a 90-minute movie, you are seeing 30 minutes of images. But your mind
is
telling you that you're seeing constant motion.
Wow.
Even though 2/3 of the time you're not seeing anything
on
screen.
Room.
And
that's mind-blowing.
That fascinated me as a child, and really, I think more than anything, led to my love of film.
Mm.
Because it became very apparent to me as a child. I used to write down my dreams and everything.
Right.
And I was very aware as a child that so films are, in some very real respect, dreams. And of course, Hollywood was always called the dream factory for all these reasons.
Right.
But when you think about how our dreams compress time, right? No dream ever lasts more than a few seconds.
Right.
We know this because we've been able to measure the energy and what's being fired off in the brain.
And even MRIs and stuff like that when people are dreaming.
And yet we've all heard people then recount their dreams.
It takes forever.
And they're minutes in the telling. Yes. And then this happened and then this happened. And a big part of that is because if people don't wake up immediately and write down their dreams, the conscious mind takes a hold of it and starts creating connections that did not exist.
Uh-huh.
You will remember that they did, but they did not actually exist. And at the same time, the dream language, it compresses time. Time works under an entirely different set of rules in our dreams.
Right.
Well, so too does it work under an entirely different set of rules in film. We know this also just as a viewer when, you know, you think about the fact that, well, I really do feel that I saw this entire person's life.
Yeah, right.
But the movie was only 2.5 hours long.
You didn't see his whole life. Yeah, like a biopic and stuff where they were compressed through editing what you felt. Like in Star Wars, the battle for the Death Star felt like it went on forever. But if you actually look at it, it's less than 10 minutes long.
And so this was a way that being a child of the time and being able to see that, you know, that's not going to be possible through, you know, digital exhibition. And certainly you don't have that experience at home if you're watching the movies or on any other sources. And so what it did, of course, was really lead me into some very interesting directions, introduced me to themes as a little boy that would become major parts of my explorations as an adult. You know, not only film, but also the study of dreams.
Right.
You know, in college, I really focused on both interpreting literature, but especially film, through the language of dreams and interpreting these as dreams.
Oh.
And of course, now as a man in my 40s, I truly appreciate the fact that the best way to appreciate the meaning in anything, even the things going on all around us, is to interpret it as if it were a dream. Because, of course, time is still just a concept that we've agreed upon.
Right, exactly.
It is not a constant.
Right. It's measured to the time the Earth goes around the sun, theoretically.
And yet, even that we have to keep adjusting for.
Right, by a quarter a day, because it speeds up and slows it.
But as is talked about in our film, The Truth Is Out There, you know, the arrow of time perhaps goes in many directions that we don't necessarily perceive, and we don't necessarily perceive it because, again, we choose not to perceive it that way.
Right, because we all are
But sitting in that movie with 60 minutes of black screen really points out the fact that we have made a deal with ourselves that we're going to perceive time a certain way.
Mm.
And if we could really see things the way they really were, how might that affect our concept of time?
Wow. Because then we'd all make an agreement not to agree. I agree to disagree on the
And that leads to chaos.
Does it?
Well, I mean, that's the fear, right?
Right.
And that's the reason we have these mental protections in place, is to prevent us from succumbing into chaos.
Wow.
Like all our defenses, right?
Right. Exactly. So, fear of chaos.
So
that is
was
fascinating.
One thing that I wanted. Now, talking about, though, how films are distributed and shown and geez, talk about, you know, what we agree upon and dreams, the dream language. I mean, all this stuff has always, to me, really resonated when I think about the internet. You know, this whole other universe. It's an actual universe.
That's, right. Cyberspace.
Exists. Cyberspace. Yeah. And a couple of recent developments have really, it seems, have people worried about the future of the internet.
Oh, really?
About multiple internets being created. We have Senator Al Franken here, who has been really, that's been the main thing that he's been trumping politically, is about how the internet and expression on the internet is really the free speech issue of the 21st century.
Right.
And about how two internets are being created, whether they are broadband-based or wireless-based.
And this is net neutrality you're talking about,
yeah,
as well, right?
Can you
go on with that?
This a little bit to me?
Well, the idea is that anybody can throw a
because
website.
Because we change the way people listen to the internet.
Yeah,
but that's only so good if there aren't corporations forcing you to look at the internet a certain way.
Well, exactly.
Or dictating what you can see and hear.
Or how, or exactly. If you've ever traveled with your laptop and you often, as you know, go to Europe and try to watch Hulu, for instance, they will say, hey, man, you can't watch that over in Europe. And you go, what? But it's my laptop. You would think that you would have that free access, that it'd be neutral around the world. But in fact, it's not. China restricts Google. Europe restricts Hulu. I mean, there's all sorts
of
restrictions.
I feel like our fans in Israel can't listen to us on iTunes.
Is that right?
I think so. It was some country did say that we're unavailable on iTunes.
Because of our explicit, sometimes naughty language?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
Well, all right. I'm going to perform stuff.
I'm just saying that it's Israel. I can't swear. But it is. But I have heard this from listeners that they're not available to download us on iTunes.
Right. And this is sort of the beginning of the idea of how net neutrality is eroding. That you can't have one website that's seen around the world that will have equal status unless you pay to be in a certain, you know, a .com or a certain bandwidth that will then allow you access to way more customers. So they're going to start charging for different things, and then gone are the days where you just throw up a website and suddenly a million people glom onto it, it becomes viral, and you sell a billion items. This will then, according to some of the government plans, FCC and stuff like that, will take that away and make it sort of a pay-to-play situation, which becomes problematic in terms of the democracy of what the internet was all about in the first place.
Right, right. And it brings to mind also this issue that people keep saying it's a freedom of speech issue.
Mm.
And so many times things will come up and going, oh, freedom of speech, and, you know, railing against how freedom of speech is being curtailed and Americans not really being so well-versed in history, not understanding that freedom of speech never had to do with you being allowed to speak whatever you wanted at every single time.
Right.
It was specifically that the government would not curtail your political speech.
Right.
The government would not curtail it. Well, now, of course, the threat to our free speech is almost never the government.
Right.
It's corporations.
Right, exactly.
Access to means to have your voice heard are controlled, for the most part, by corporations.
The ISP.
Except historically on the internet.
Right. Yeah.
But now, things like the big NBC Universal Comcast merger, the takeover of NBC Universal, the sale by Comcast, which...
Huge.
And no one really, it seems to me, of reasonable mind advocated this thing. Almost everybody said that this is a really, really bad idea.
Bad idea. But it's a huge gravitational pull now of media.
And so you've got a couple of things that kind of, you know, manifest almost immediately. How about Keith Olbermann not being renewed at MSNBC? Now, Keith Olbermann is, for those people who don't know, he's a pundit,
mm-hmm,
who hosts an hourly exercise in punditry on MSNBC, one of our 24-hour news stations here, like CNN or Fox News. And it's of a decidedly left bent, MSNBC, and certainly his show. And some people love it. And, of course, some people can't stand him. And, you know, much like Bill O'Reilly and Glenn Beck and these all the other things, it, you know, these networks are in the entertainment business.
Absolutely.
And they find a niche. And they try to make money off of it. And they do it. Now, here's the thing, is that there had been talk that because Comcast is owned by very conservative people politically, who, among other things, are the people that threw Bush's second inaugural gala, that they would they would automatically curve the left politics of MSNBC and take a right turn on it. And everybody was really kind of fearful of that. And
seems to be coming to the fore.
Well, you know, the first thing is that one could argue that MSNBC was trailing in the ratings to Fox. So as a business, you change things to compete.
If you're sucking.
The issue with Keith Olbermann, though, that's really interesting is that he was their flagship, you know, their
the
flagship
biggest rated,
show.
Yeah.
He was their highest rated show.
Yeah. So why are you cutting that?
That's what's really interesting.
Yeah.
And again, but it's not an issue of freedom of speech because it's a corporation.
Yeah, it's a
and
business decision.
And they get
decision.
To have their own rules.
Right.
And they answer supposedly to their shareholders, et cetera. And that's how it's kept in mind. However, this is the thing. So it's not the government.
Right.
But when a merger like this needs government approval and the government approves it, then it seems maybe you are opening the door for the idea of, you know, it being a freedom of speech issue.
Right. Yeah, because this becomes
because you have abdicated your power as a government agency to the corporation.
Right.
So it becomes very interesting.
Wow.
But and we really do need to then look at, you know, maybe rephrase this freedom of speech issue. And, you know, maybe it does become a thing about a constitutional amendment to protect freedom of speech from corporate influence.
Yeah. Well, then let me put this moral quandary to you that I met a ex-philosophy professor from NYU who was also a conduit for bootlegging software, of all things. And I said, how morally can you, all these programmers that are putting together Microsoft Word and stuff like that, how can you go and undermine their ability to make money for the hard work of coding these things? And he said, look, the programs are the language we now use to communicate. If the guys who came up with the Arabic, you know, the Phoenicians and the alphabet put a copyright of 5 cents for every time you use the letter A in a book, we would not have any of the literature or the culture that we have today.
If they patented,
if there was a monetary gain for the work they did of creating language,
try to do this, right? Don't they? Don't companies try to do this? Trademarking a phrase,
trademarking a certain program. The buy now button. Amazon tried to copyright the buy now button.
A major corporation leaning on us because of a certain phrase that is used as a title of a film.
Donald. Oh, yes, that's right. Even though it's not even trademarked. That's right. So, you know, these sort of things, these become, the internet opens up not just opportunities, but real moral quandaries that, you know, go back to the very basics. And I don't have a counter argument for that guy on that.
Well, and then you read about, you know, a company that's suing Twitter because they were actually granted a patent on social networking that involves communication and following celebrities. And the celebrity component of Twitter, which is actually used to advertise Twitter, they're suing. And the truth is they were granted a patent, the exclusive patent. So it'll be very interesting to see what comes about on that.
And this is sort of your opening.
Because
up.
It's if nothing else, it's an absolute disregard of what patent law was supposed to be about.
Yeah, because, you know, I know a guy who's got 62 patents and he's being sued because everybody stole these patents out from under him. And the major companies like FedEx and UPS, the lawyer said to them, going, hey, man, we will bury your lawyer, you'll bury your next lawyer because we have the resources to wait you out. This isn't about justice. It's about resources.
Now, one of the interesting things about this Comcast takeover of NBC Universal, one of the first things they're going to do is pull all NBC and Universal programming, that's movies and television shows, from Netflix.
Oh.
As soon as that contract expires. And there's a lot of fear that they're going to try to kill Netflix. And, and people are upset about that. Again, Al Franken saying that, see, they're going to try to kill off less expensive sources of bringing this entertainment to people.
Right, and charge more.
And, of course, my feelings about this are twofold. One, I'm not sure that's a bad thing.
Right.
Because companies that pay to make entertainment need to be able to stand a chance to see the money back, or else the entertainment is not going to get created.
Sure.
And, of course, it's not like storytellers were ever sharing in the Netflix model at all.
Right.
Either.
True.
And so there's that. But there's the second thing, and I talked about this almost 2 years ago on this show, that Netflix was opening up the door for their own demise. Because they got so big, so fast, by really befriending all the independents. By saying, this is a place where you're going to be able to get everything. Then they started over the last couple of years now to start weeding out the smaller ones.
Right.
Because they need more and more access and room and bandwidth and shelf space for the big ones.
For the big movies, the big money makers.
But they grew originally as a site for film lovers.
Right.
Which was, this was the site for people who loved movies because you could get everything.
Right.
There.
Yeah.
You didn't have to go anywhere else. That's how they killed off Blockbusters and the traditional rental stores, because as a film lover, you could get everything.
Yeah.
You might not be able to get it right when you wanted it because there was no streaming at that point, but you knew within a few days you were going to get it no matter what it was, so you had to have a membership.
Yeah.
Because you would always get what you wanted. Now they've started to curb it and started to squeeze out smaller companies. Meanwhile, the big companies who were not profiting from Netflix.
Right.
At some point, we're going to find out a way to squeeze them out.
Yeah, exactly. Because actually, Netflix actually ruined the DVD sales, because that used to be a big chunk of the market. It was people buying, and then once you could just rent from Netflix, that sort of ditched how that whole
and
market
let's face
was
it, we do live in an age where no matter how big you get, if you do not stay ahead of the curve, I mean, Blockbuster seemed unbeatable.
Right.
As it'll go as 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Right? In fact, Blockbuster had gotten to the point where it was almost one of those words that was interchangeable with the service that they provided.
Right.
You know, it was Blockbuster meant video rental.
Yeah, I'm going to go Blockbuster.
Like I'm going to go Xerox this. No,
yeah,
you're going to photocopy it. You don't know if you're going to do it on a Xerox. I need a Q-tip. Do you need a Q-tip or do you need a cotton swab?
Yeah. Interesting.
So, yeah.
So they have their own demise. Well, I know. They should have never taken Karl Rove, I Love You off their...
They shouldn't have bowed to pressure.
That's right. Those bastards. Yeah, well,
it's gonna bite him in the ass.
Well, let's we'll be there to fill in the gap.
What?
No, I don't know.
I don't even know. You know, speaking of the internet,
let's because we are on the internets.
You plural. Know, we're in award season.
Oh yes,
and the internet's playing a bigger and bigger part in the awards, making these screeners available online for SAG members. You know, you can download for free off iTunes all the nominated films.
Can I?
And yeah, you could have, yeah.
If I was a SAG member?
Yeah, you are a SAG member, and you could, yeah.
Still?
They provided all the free codes for us, yeah, and everything. I'm right. Just saying, I don't know. You need to do it by, I guess the ballots are due either today or at the end of this week, so you have to. And in fact, I was going to suggest that we fill in our online ballots on the show today, but since you've seen nothing, that would be sort of,
I haven't got my SAG ballot mailed to me.
See, this is the thing. That's the point. There are no mailed ballots anymore. It's online. You got a piece of mail that said that it's only available online. You needed to request a ballot by December 14th if you wanted a paper ballot. And this is why this is news that a lot of SAG members are angry, because it's confusing. They don't know how to do it. They don't know.
And, I'm confused.
And we have a name for these people. Well, Dean Hagler. But also, they tend to be older.
What's that about?
And so there's claim that it's ageism.
I see.
That's
for the kids, the skewed to the
and
kids.
And of course, the older members were the ones most likely to vote originally.
Yeah,
and,
right.
But meanwhile, SAG had for years been getting great acclaim from the environmental movement because they had been going more and more paperless, more and more environmentally friendly, and doing more of this stuff online. And but I just need to repeat the story that I witnessed that told me where this particular award season was heading with these problems. And, you know, at one point it seemed like The Social Network was a shoo-in to win Best Picture.
Yeah.
Until the other night when at the Producers Guild Awards, The King's Speech pulled the big upset victory in the Producers Guild. Because the Producers Guild generally favors the big box office successes.
Yeah.
The producers like the big box office. Well, last year, Avatar seemed like it was running a runaway freight train to the Oscar until at the Producers Awards, The Hurt Locker, the least box office of any Producers Guild winner of all time, beat it. And so this year it seemed like we had another runaway with The Social Network until last night or two nights ago at the Producers Guild. But I knew when I saw Social Network at the Directors Guild that it wasn't the runaway that everybody thought that it was. And the problem was expressed most beautifully by these two women in front of me in line to see the next award hopeful movie, which was Wall Street 2.
Oh,
we'd all just come out of Social Network. We had to get in line again for Wall Street 2 outside the Directors Guild. And these two women, older women, lovely women, who had just seen The Social Network, one turned to the other one and said, "But what is the Facebook?" Just seen a whole movie about it and had never heard of Facebook.
It's not been, you know, you could miss that website.
When you talk about online voting and you talk about the Academy Awards, and let's face it, the Academy skews very old indeed, it never seemed to me that Social Network was the foregone conclusion everybody seemed to think.
I know, and The King's Speech has that a bit. I just saw it last night. Huh?
Yeah, I mean, what is missing from The King's Speech that would derail its possibilities as a Best Picture? I mean, it seems to any if we came up with a list of the things that you really need to have in order to be an Academy Award hopeful for Best Picture, not top critical film or even necessarily best film or anything like this, but for the Academy and what historically they look for.
Yeah.
Doesn't King's Speech almost seem like a paint by numbers?
Absolutely.
We've got to hit this box.
We've got to hit this box. The lead actor has to have some sort of mild disability. They triumph over
adversity. Told you about how great his performance was when I saw that all those months ago.
And
Colin Firth is a wonderful actor. I've always loved Colin Firth. However, in seeing some of his earlier films, I realized that, he, in real life, overcame a stammer.
Did he really?
That's so why it makes you think about his performance and go, well, I don't know now if... It's not that it's a worse performance. I mean, the performance doesn't get less good because he himself had the experience with that.
Yeah.
Because let's face it, how you judge a performance, if we're really going to judge it beyond the ludicrous nature of the competitions for awards, is do I believe the character?
Oh, yeah.
Do I believe the world? And of course you do. It's just that he's the best actor because, oh my God, what
that
he stammer did with the
so
stammer.
Good,
and it's like, well, maybe it wasn't the big challenge, the big high dive that it necessarily seemed like it was.
So that was just him, doing this. Well, now that changes everything, doesn't it?
Well, I still love that. Because I don't know how many people will know that. Yeah. And again, should it change it?
Yeah, true enough.
But we do know that a lot of times people vote for these acting awards based on the high dive element.
Yeah, right.
She's really pretty in real life, but she put on an ugly nose for this. How brave, how courageous.
Halle Berry, best actress, ladies and gentlemen. Exactly.
So I guess we won't fill out our SAG ballots right now. But there is some other stuff about SAG that's kind of interesting.
Oh?
I thought, hearing that the board of the Screen Actors Guild unanimously passed a motion allocating $70,000 in additional funding to something called the SAG-AFTRA Relations Task Force. A unanimous vote, and the allocation will fund the continuing efforts of the task force and the President's Forum for One Union to develop a framework for the formation of a new union.
Oh.
Combining the members of Screen Actors Guild and AFTRA.
SAGTRA.
But isn't that interesting? I mean, it's not a... That doesn't sound like a merger to me, where one gets enfolded into another.
That's
it
dissolving.
Is a new union.
Yeah, because then they can get off of their pension problems and all the health care.
It's what you and I were talking about years ago.
Yeah.
Seems like only weeks. back when you were Canadian.
Back when
we
I was
used
Canadian.
To talk about this, that it's going to have to solve two problems.
So many problems.
The ability of AFTRA to undercut SAG in negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to have to answer AFTRA's pension problems, the huge pension deficits.
Yeah.
And anybody who thinks that it wasn't going to do it, you know, and said that it shouldn't do it or whatever, well, it's short-sighted because it's going to have to.
It's
if you want to eliminate the threat of what AFTRA is doing to the living wage of working actors, you're going to have to solve their problem for them.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
Yeah.
And it's,
and I guess that's what's going to happen through a new union. It also makes you wonder if it is the formation of a new union, will people have to rejoin? Will they have to pay membership fees again?
Can I be grandfathered in?
It'll be interesting.
Ugh.
And if it's a new union,
truly,
I would imagine that the union exists as a corporation in some sense.
Yeah, it has its own.
And so if you create a new one, a new incorporation of a union, which means the cessation of the old union, do you get out from underneath your pension requirements?
Ah, that's interesting.
I don't know.
Holy
smokes.
But I
mean, that's why, like, when you see these movies, you know, you'll think you're seeing a Warner Brothers movie, but then you'll see the name of the company that financed it, and it's like some Nevada Shell Corporation.
Yeah, exactly.
And the reason is manyfold. One of the things is that you do that so that if somebody sues for whatever reason, they can't come after the parent company.
Right.
They can come after the production.
Yeah.
And there are certain reasons why that makes sense.
Sure.
If someone associated with the production does something, steals an idea from someone or whatever else, you can't go after Warner Brothers for the... You
take
know,
them down.
People always go after the deep pockets.
Yeah.
But it's also, let's face it, it's a tax and auditing dodge an investment dodge.
Nevada's a tax-free state.
Well, and you know, we shut down. The production went bankrupt. And you can't come after Warner Brothers for your share in the profits.
Yeah, exactly.
So it'll be interesting.
Yes. I'm worried now.
You know, speaking of Warner Brothers, there was something in the news, actually, about how, like, Warner Brothers is becoming remake central.
Yeah.
And you were just mentioning before we were going on about how there's going to be more Matrix sequels.
How can there be more Matrix sequels?
Because they didn't do them in 3D. So now they could make films even worse and charge more money for them.
And that was the whole Matrix ended so stupidly. I mean, it got worse and worse. And the architect, what the hell is that?
And you always said that, you know, and it was, and you meant it really derisively that you didn't think that the guys that made the first Matrix really understood why it was successful.
I don't think so.
And it's not to be derisive because again, much artistry is unconscious,
right?
And so, you know, did they do a wonderful job of creating consciously a framework where this unconscious expression could reach fruition? Of course they did.
Yeah.
So they really did do their jobs, and they did their jobs consciously. What then happens, though, is you need to make sequels to this because it was so successful.
Right.
And then you go in consciously saying, okay, well, how do we continue this story, and how do we develop it,
right,
and how do we do it? Regardless of whether anything wants to come forward that is a deepening of that story anyway.
Right. And that if you don't understand why that story was successful, you're just going to play up the elements that were not the successful part for the most part, and therefore show yourselves to be the true idiots that you are.
But so I have, of course, defended on this show
many times
remakes as a form, you know, saying, everybody calm down. The original is not being taken away from us.
Right.
And all it is perhaps, think of it the way that I do, which is many people are going to hear about the original who never even knew it existed.
Yes.
Okay.
Like how many versions of Star is Born have you seen? There's like four other versions.
Right, and there's going to be a new one
from
Warner Brothers, I guess, with Clint Eastwood directing it.
No.
Yeah, Clint Eastwood is directing it and Beyonce is starring in it.
No!
He has so many films lined up, like this J. Edgar Hoover thing. I mean, he will never die, will he?
No, well, no.
He can't because he's just too busy.
He's too busy, and his directing style is very calming. It seems that it actually will lengthen his life.
Yeah.
Like Jack LaLanne, who also passed away today.
Yeah. Yeah. So. And indeed, directing a film is much like pulling boats filled with people through ice-cold water with your teeth. It really is like that many times.
On the way to Alcatraz. That's right.
So Warner Brothers, in addition to these, they're looking at remaking The Dirty Dozen. Oh, God. Ooh. I mean, how many sequels of that did they have unnecessarily,
right?
Including Oh, God, You Devil?
Well, who's going to do George Burns?
They're bringing Tarzan back, a reboot of Tarzan.
I can see that.
Okay. Lethal Weapon with an all-new cast.
Well, yeah.
You know, Shane Black, who wrote the original one, had written a new one for the original cast.
Oh.
And they, I guess, could not strike deals with everyone. And then there was, I guess, Mel Gibson's had a little problem.
No problem. He's finally found another agent, though.
So they ended up saying, no, we're not going to do it with the original cast, but they're going to retool the his script for the new sequel and do a reboot of Lethal Weapon.
Hmm. Yeah. Okay, you know what? I guess I...
But why do we need it even... How about just do... You know, Lethal Weapon, right? Lethal Weapon did not do anything that unique.
Yeah.
It was a buddy cop movie in the 80s where we loved buddy cop movies.
Yeah.
And it's, again, it's like the idea of, well, we just... It's almost like it's become the title for buddy cop movies.
Yeah.
It's like it's Xerox.
Yeah, we're doing
it's Xerox to photocopiers.
We're going to do a Lethal Weapon with, exactly. Well, it's funny, too, because I think it's Shane Black that really was the star of that whole franchise. Because if you read that original script, it was very funny in the action sequences that he would write. He would go, and amazingly, hold on to your popcorn, folks. He jumps over the wall into moving traffic. And it's like, hold on to your popcorn, folks. He put that in the screenplay. It was hilarious.
So they're doing a Westworld remake, and now this is a film that
Yul
great
Brenner.
Film Yul Brenner, Richard Peter, Benjamin,
Peter Fonda,
was in the sequel Future
right.
World,
yeah. Future World,
Michael Crichton made
oh,
Westworld,
yeah, right.
And because he directed movies, people forget this, and it's fine to me that they're remaking this. They might make it really cool. It might be whatever, but also. Many people who've never seen the original now might know about it. It'll get more play. It'll get a re-release and stuff like that.
Sure.
It's kind of cool.
Okay.
But The Wild Bunch?
What? Where are you going to find even 8 actors that you want to see on screen?
Yeah, veteran actors with gravitas?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's all going to be... I mean, who do we have that's middle-aged with gravitas? Well, I guess the closest thing we have to a William Holden is George Clooney. But again, he's had so much work done, and with the veneers and everything, it's like that. He's not William Holden in the Old West.
No.
So they're all being remade. And then it's not just Warner Brothers. You've got, you know, a new Ghostbusters that's going to be made if Bill Murray says yes.
Right.
But it's going to serve the purpose of handing it off to a new generation.
Right, a bunch of kids.
Although, let's see how that works. I mean, that was the idea behind the last indie film, right?
Right.
Harrison Ford's going to hand off to Shia LaBeouf.
And now they
might do another indie film, but they're bringing back Harrison Ford. They're not,
So,
I don't know. And then you read that 2 Avatar sequels that are going to be coming out, Christmas of 2014 and Christmas of 2015. And, of course, you know... that I did not enjoy the Evader at all.
I did know that.
But what I love about it and why it's good news is it's proof positive that we can ignore all the end of the world diatribes for 2012 because if anyone is a mouthpiece for the Illuminati, it's Jim Cameron. And if he knows that it's safe to be releasing these blockbusters in 2014 and 2015, 1, the world's still going to be here.
Yep.
2, movie cinemas are still going to be here. And 3, the economy will be good enough where you can make trillions more at the box office. Because he wouldn't waste his time.
No, he would already be on his planned NASA Mars rover that he designed.
Right, or deep under the ocean surface, that city that I know he's built down there.
Yeah, exactly, that he used in The Abyss.
He is, to me, the villain in Moonraker.
Oh.
Or no, is it Spy Who Loved Me?
Spy Who Loved Me.
Or Moonraker. He has a space station out there, and he has an underwater city.
That's hilarious. That should be the next James Bond. It was actually a giant movie director.
But for all of this sucking the bones of dead artists dry through remakes,
uh-huh.
Occasionally.
Something?
There are, even in this age where we think we have access to everything all the time, with the internet and all this.
You have hope.
There is a hidden treasure that sometimes gets unveiled.
What?
It was one of the real sad, painful things for me growing up as a film lover, that the final feature film by my favorite filmmaker, Orson Welles, would be one that I would never be able to see.
Because?
He made a film that supposedly was every bit the equal of his classics beforehand.
Wow.
He made it in the 70s. It was called The Other Side of the Wind. And it was financed by the Shah of Iran and the family of the Shah of Iran.
Wow.
So after the fall, it became a real legal hot potato.
Right.
That ended with him being allowed to have one private showing of this film for friends and family and the people who worked on it in Beverly Hills. One showing. And then the Iranian government was seizing control of the prints and the negatives and destroying them because, you know, Western filmmaking was everything that the new regime was against.
Right.
And the people who were there that night said that this was, you know, his breathtaking masterpiece. This, not Citizen Kane, was his breathtaking masterpiece. And he died without ever making another feature film.
Wow.
Well, all the raw footage
of
that film has been uncovered.
Where?
And there is talk of a release happening at some point. The question right now is, are they going to release the raw footage, or are they going to edit it together and release the film? And so then the question is, who's going to supervise it? Many people are advocating that Peter Bogdanovich, who was closer to Welles than anyone, that he supervised the putting together of this movie. But interesting that still this treasure in cinematic history that could be uncovered. And then, at the same time, more recently, you know, it's Hollywood lore that, of course, Quentin Tarantino broke big with his first film, Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah.
But of course, as all of us have always known, that was not his first feature film.
No.
He had a feature film that he made in 1984 called My Best Friend's Birthday.
Yeah, right.
That he shot on 16mm, and he ensured that no one would ever see this so that when he did make Reservoir Dogs, that could be submitted to all these festivals and win these awards as best first feature.
Right.
A marketing
Very ploy. Clever marketing ploy. Very clever.
Well, now, I guess, 36 minutes from that film, the only 36 minutes that still survive are available online.
No.
And so if you look at IMDb, the first credit for Quentin Tarantino is a short film called My Best Friend's Birthday.
No.
But it's 36 minutes from his original.
Certainly he's not supervising putting that up. How did that get up
know.
There? And how did that get linked to IMDb? That seems odd.
Like, because it's available. I mean,
yeah, but still,
and people are in it, and people put it on. Yeah, I mean, if you can link it to an actual site where it can be seen, then it'll get put on there.
Because it
does exist.
Guess where I'm going?
to try to start editing the other side of the wind.
Yes, I'm the guy. I got great ideas.
Or as we call it, hell gigs. That is something that needs to be edited.
Oh, Jesus.
There is a project.
Okay, I'm in. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm.
Well, boy, that brings us to a conclusion of another action-packed.
Action-packed? Holy smokes, that was packed with information. I learned that I have to go and vote online for SAG. I should have looked at my mail more closely. I learned there's movies that I haven't seen that I got to go see.
Now, programming note,
oh, yeah.
We were going to be doing our top 10 films of 2010.
Mm-hmm.
Next Monday, the Oscar nominations come out tomorrow, Tuesday. Well, I guess people listen to this at different times of the week, but they come out Tuesday the 25th, 5:30 a.m. out here in the Pacific time. Nominations are announced, and then traditionally the following Monday we record our top 10 films of the preceding year.
Right.
So we always like to do it right after the guilds announce their awards,
and
yet
like
a month before the Oscars.
Right.
This year, because we are going to be doing a special show next Monday, focusing on an aspect of filmmaking we have never really discussed in any detail at all, a show that I think will be very informative for aspiring filmmakers.
Yes.
Also for filmmakers who are making movies.
Who are already inspired.
There is always more that you can learn about this particular subject. We won't mention what it is. But also, our guest is a very engaging, super hilarious guy.
Lots
so
of
it
fun.
Promises to be a very, very good special theme show that we will be bringing to people this coming week. So our top 10 of 2010 will be in the first Monday of February.
Which would allow me to go and see some of these things.
I wasn't going to say that. I wasn't going to call you out on that.
I call myself on
it. Yeah. I would like you to see those because it is always embarrassing when we call that special theme show our top 10 of 2010 or 10 films Dean has seen.
Yeah, well, this year I saw a lot of stinkers. So
I know you did.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, you should just count down the 10 worst and I'll do this.
Oh, hey, that'd be fun, actually. That would be fun because I've seen the 10 worst.
Until next week, I am Dean. No, who are you?
Well, I'm Dean Haglund.
Right, and I'm Phil Lernis. We're both Americans.
Now.
Yeah.
In your face.
You can find every episode at least for a couple weeks.
Yes.
That we have ever done at chillpackhollywood.com. Download, stream, subscribe via iTunes. But please send us a message as soon as you can. chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. And we'll make sure that if you want to, we can keep you informed about how and where to listen to your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. And how and where to see a movie called The Truth Is Out There.
You're going to love it. Until next week. See you then.